welcome to the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zachary Elwood. This is a podcast about understanding human behavior. You can learn more about it and get more details about episodes at peoplewhoreadpeople.com. This episode is about lie detectors, aka polygraphs. I've touched on polygraphs in several past episodes a bit, but never done a full episode about them. A 2018 Wired magazine article reported that an estimated 2.5 million polygraph tests were given each year in the United States, with the majority administered to paramedics, police officers, firefighters, and state troopers. The average cost to administer the test is more than $700 and is part of a $2 billion industry. The reason I was thinking about this recently was I watched a documentary on Netflix called American Nightmare, which involves some very unfair and scary treatment that some people received at the hands of police investigators in California. In one of the scenes, an innocent victim who the police wrongly suspected was guilty of murder or kidnapping was told by the investigators that he had failed a polygraph when he'd actually passed in order to intimidate him and make a confession more likely. So this got me wondering some of the same questions about polygraphs that I've had over the years. It seems widely known that they're not reliable and that they seem to be mainly used as a way to get people talking. I was curious to talk to someone who's researched this area and could answer some questions I was curious about. I reached out to psychologist Leonard Sachs, who's known for, amongst other things, his research on polygraphs. His research and testimony has been key in some legal decisions involving polygraphs. For example, his 1983 report for Congress ended up leading to a nationwide ban on private employers giving polygraph tests to employees. A 1998 Supreme Court decision that ruled against the use of polygraphic evidence in some federal courts also relied on his work. Topics we discuss include why polygraphs and other forms of deception detection are unreliable, their use as a tool to extract confessions, the Richard Ames case, which involved a high-level CIA employee spying for the Soviet Union and beating a polygraph when questioned, a story where someone's life was ruined due to cops trusting polygraph evidence far too much, and more. As I'm reading this, yesterday there was an attempted murder of President Trump. Really quickly, I wanted to read something I wrote about this on Twitter. Obviously, political violence is bad. What is more important and non-obvious about the Trump shooting from a political polarization angle is that toxic polarization makes many of us react in increasingly irrational, team-based ways to one-off events. For example, if Biden were attacked, many people would slot that incident into their preferred narratives, for example, saying things like these crazy Trump supporters. If Trump were attacked, as he was, many people would slot that into their preferred narratives, for example, saying things like these crazy liberals. For either incident, some people on the other side will reach for pessimistic, conspiracy-minded ideas. For example, on the left in this case, you saw people saying this was planned, it was staged to help Trump win, these kinds of things. Conflict makes us increasingly unable to rationally process the very results of that conflict. We derange ourselves, we become hypersensitive to the things that conflict creates. And we should remember that violent and chaotic and random things can happen even in the absence of extreme polarization. They can happen at any time. For example, the 60s were turbulent with much violence, but America wasn't nearly as polarized in binary us versus them ways as we are now. We're good at crafting big grand narratives. We're storytellers. After all, that is what we do. But we should be careful to not build faulty narratives based on big emotion-producing events. To help us avoid worst-case scenarios of dysfunction and chaos, we need more people to try as much as they're able to take more high-level, bird's-eye views of our conflict, to see things more from long-term perspectives, and to attempt to imagine events from the perspective of the, quote, other side, even as they work towards their preferred political goals. I wrote more, but that was some of what I wrote on Twitter. If you think it's important that we as a country reduce toxic polarization and political contempt, You might like reading one of my books on the subject, which you can learn more about at American-Anger.com. About my recent book, How Contempt Destroys Democracy, Kirkus Reviews said this: compelling arguments based on astute observations and backed by solid research. They also said it was brief and accessible. Okay, here's the talk with lie detector researcher Leonard Sachs. Hi, Len. Thanks for coming on the show.
Glad to be with you.
So, maybe we can start with if you had to sum up the practical usefulness of lie detectors in a few sentences, what would you say about that in regards to how useful they are at detecting deception and what that percentage of reliability looks like?
They're not useful. And in fact, they can be misleading. Whether they find a person deceptive or non-deceptive, you really don't know. You have to look at the actual evidence, physiological indicators, autonomic nervous system indicators that are measured in polygraph. There's simply no basis to assume that they're a reliable indicator of whether somebody's telling the truth or not.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously, it's known that lie detectors are not reliable. They're not admissible in court. Many people have talked about their unreliability. Do you have a sense these days of how widely they're used, and if you do have a sense of how widely they're used, is it mainly, I'm gathering, because they are just an intimidation tactic for getting answers, getting people to talk?
Well, the polite way of saying it is that they're used as an investigative tool, and it's hard to know how many tests are administered and what role they play. Government agencies use them, police agency use them. It's even used in probation cases, but that doesn't make them reliable. The fact that they're used is a problem.
Yeah, what got me interested in this most recently, I was watching this documentary, American Nightmare, which was good. I recommend it. And it had this scene where the police were using a lie detector, and clearly, like you said, and you could call it an investigative tactic, it just seemed like a pure intimidation tactic, though, because they were quite literally saying, "You failed the lie detector," even though, he didn't fail it, and they were just purely using it as an intimidation tactic, which seems, I guess it's like you say, it's probably hard to get a sense of how often that kind of thing happens because nobody's really tracking how that's used. But it just and it's also interesting to me in the fact that it seems so widely known at this point that that's, how it's used, because even in many TV shows they talk about this, about how it's not, not reliable, not admissible in court, and used to get information and such. So it seems like an interesting scenario that so many people know this, but yet it still seems so often used.
I mean, in one of the ways that it's used as intimidation is that the polygrapher convince the subject that they can determine how truthful or not truthful they are. A subject who's guilty may actually make a confession. And in that sense, it's served its purpose. It's been useful because it got a confession. You could say this about all forms of interrogation. Why do subjects do it without the advice of a lawyer or having a lawyer present? How investigators use essentially suggesting that they know what the answer is and they just need some of the details and so on, investigative tactics. What's really problematic about the polygraph, though, is that it has this veneer of science and validity, which in fact decades, actually a century of research has made clear is not the case, and not the case for most widely used techniques in polygraph.
Are there people, considering how widely known it is that they're not reliable, I was curious, are there people that still will defend it as being a reliable source of information, or is that, or does pretty much nobody do that anymore?
There's a trade association, the American Polygraph Association, and there are even some psychologists who work with them who defend it. On some level, it's not surprising. We'd like to believe that the polygraph is accurate. We'd like to believe that people can't get away with lying. Famous physician, Lewis Thomas, an essayist, one's called the polygraph, the smoke alarm in the brain. And like how wonderful it is that human beings were built with this indicator that they were not telling the truth. And I think a lot of people would like to believe that. A lot of people would like to believe that people can't get away with lying. And what's interesting is that lying, whether it's in the context of politics or whether it's in the context of criminal activity or even where politics and criminal activity come together, are increasingly critical issues. It's what we talk about every day in the news. I haven't done a systematic study, but police shows and crime shows on TV are a staple of popular culture. So we're all concerned about finding the truth and knowing the truth. And we have this belief that there are tools available to do it, that there are certain signals that people give when they're being dishonest. The problem is that the scientific basis of that is very problematic.
Yeah, and I had a great interview talk about this with Tim Levine about his work and talking about the difficulty, if not impossibility, of detecting when someone's lying accurately. But I'm curious, considering how known it is, how unreliable polygraphs are, do you have opinions on why? For example, you said some psychologists will still defend and write about the reliability, promote the reliability of lie detectors. Do you have opinions on, what, how are people still able to do that, considering how, known it is that how unreliable they are?
There are lots of practices. I mean, even in medicine, even common things like taking medication for colds. There are many conditions the medication doesn't do a whole lot. It's not efficacious, but it's only in very recent years that medicine has moved to be evidence-based practice. I also think that there may be some correlations with deception. In other words, there may be some behaviors that in most situations, for many people, most people are indicative that they're not telling the truth. Basically, that people are more nervous when they're telling a lie. But it doesn't apply to many of the situations in which it is most important. A crime has been committed, so on. And it also has to be looked at in context. The person who lies repeatedly, says the same thing over and over again, might take political figures as examples of this. They get up and 100 times a day, they defend their position. They make a argument at the trial, Donald Trump's trial in New York recently, where you had a set of witnesses, each of whom told a story, and Donald Trump told his own story. All of the stories could not be true. Somebody is not telling the truth, But in each case, whether it was Michael Cohen, whether it was Stormy Daniels, whether it was Donald Trump, each of them had told the story that they testified to, or their lawyers represented, hundreds and hundreds of times. And any emotional reaction, any anxiety, whatever, psychology would say, it's likely that it habituated. The analogy would be, you know, stand in the middle of a highway with cars whizzing by 70 miles an hour, and boy, would that be frightening for the first couple of minutes. But if you survive, over time, any anxiety associated with that diminishes. So that's one of the issues. Another issue is that the cases in which it has been most important to apply polygraph, a murder case, a rape case, an espionage case, and so on, they are so unique that you can't replicate those cases, and they have such importance to the individual. You can't replicate them in laboratory situations to test it. One of the reasons that the Supreme Court in a case in the 1990s decided that polygraph evidence was not sufficiently reliable to be used in even in defense of a person in a criminal trial.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall Credit Card Bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.
It's acceptable and it's defensible to use the polygraph, even knowing it's unreliable, as long as you're not, it seems like there's two main problems, right? It's like the main risk is people, investigators or other people, taking that as reliable information and acting as if it's reliable information. That can be quite bad if they're using that is evidence, which they're not, mostly, it seems, because most people know it's not. But then the other risk is, the other main risk I see is getting false confessions. And I'm curious if you've heard about polygraphs playing a role in extracting false confessions.
Not specifically, but I have seen, and there was a recent case, actually 3 or 4 years ago in Florida, where a man was, on the basis of a polygraph, arrested for murdering his mother. He gave the police, he had walked in on the murder, and he himself was stabbed. His arm was cut open. He'd given the police a description of the person who he thought he saw running away. And on the basis of the polygraph, they decided to arrest him. He was in jail 3 or 4 months before they identified the person who actually did it, had met the, was similar to the description that they that this man had given. And what was really terrible about it is, even after he was released, the sheriff refused to acknowledge that he was innocent. Now, eventually, and I think by this point, the person who actually killed the woman was convicted, had done similar crimes. Whether call it in psychology confirmation bias. The police had a hunch it was this person. They do a polygraph. The polygraph is actually not even done to the standards of the polygraph industry. Shows that he's deceptive, that he's lying about not having done it, that someone else at the scene. But his entire life was ruined. was in jail, lost his job, family members shunned him, etc.
Yeah, so that seems like something I wouldn't have expected to happen, but based on, like, it seems like, correct me if I'm wrong, but that seems like totally against the protocol of how a lie detector should be used based legally. Like, it shouldn't be used as evidence, right, to arrest someone. Am I right on that?
Right. Yeah. But even, you know, even in other cases, in some ways the most famous one is Aldrich Ames, the spy who worked for the CIA and was ultimately responsible, actually, for the deaths of multiple assets of the CIA. This was in the 80s. He was arrested in the early 90s. He had multiple polygraph tests, which he passed. Even when he was imprisoned, he wrote about them. I had consulted with people in government, and I told them, I said, look, if you get, they asked me the question, they said something like, Professor Sachs, we know you're a patriot. We know you would want to do everything to protect the security of our country. Why wouldn't you want us to use a polygraph to ferret out the people who are undermining our national security? And I said, first of all, if you get a deception indicated result, you still have to find out whether it's actually true. You have to have some evidence to back that up. In Ames's case, and they gave me, this was before he was arrested, they gave me some of the outlines of what they knew, that there was this guy selling information to the Soviets going to foreign capital. I must have said something like, I'm not an investigator, but why aren't you looking at his passport, his travel records, his bank accounts, how he's getting, spending money, and so on. But, you know, the other side is, if he doesn't pass the test, you're in the same situation. You got to find out, this could be a false negative. And we know that it's possible to train people to pass polygraph exams. And it's foolish to assume that somebody working at this level and with would not have availed himself, that the Soviets at the time would not have availed themselves of that kind of training. So it was not a surprise to me when he later was arrested and the details of what happened came out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it seems, and I talked about this a good amount with Tim Levine in another episode, but I can see the argument for using the lie detector in similar ways to other very unreliable ways of gathering information, where it can be used to, like, kind of direct your attention. But as you say, you know, you have to acknowledge that it's just very unreliable. So even if you get a slight clue like that, or some other sort of slight clue, you still have to do so much work, you know, real work of putting the pieces together. So it's just it kind of seems to me to be most helpful if you literally, or if you have very little other information to go on, right? If you're like, say you had a bunch of people and you had no other clues, and you were like, well, maybe we can get a sense of where to direct our attention with the slight information that a polygraph might provide. But that seems to me like the most useful case is when you really don't have much information at all, and you're kind of wondering, like, where do I even direct my attention at this point? But yeah, that in real life, though, that would seem to be very few and far between.
No, but there are lots of cases where they may not have any specific evidence. They just may have a hunch, or this person may be involved. But that's also the most dangerous place and situation in which to use it, because the danger is, if you don't have any information and you don't get a confession, or you don't get additional information provided by the subject under the threat of the polygraph, then you run a very serious risk of making an error.
Mm-hmm. And messing somebody's life up too, you know, and that's the worst.
Not only messing somebody else's life up, but in, you know, in the case of somebody who's working for a national security agency, also threatening the security of the country. Mm-hmm. So it's very dangerous, I think. Mm-hmm. And I want to go back to my fundamental point. We say there's no unique psychophysiological response to lying, that being deceptive doesn't have any indicator. There's no, Pinocchio is a children's story. Your nose doesn't necessarily get longer. Some people, when asked questions about a crime, even if they had nothing to do with it, are going to be nervous because their integrity is under question. And the way the test is structured, where they have comparison questions or so-called control questions, the assumption is that the polygrapher can ask questions that everybody will lie to, and they can gauge their baseline level of reaction to lying. But there's no real comparison in many of these situations. It's not a standardized test, and it's very problematic. We don't have a way of getting into people's heads right now, and we've tried lots of things. It's not just the simple psychophysiological measures of a classic polygraph test, heart rate changes, sweating, breathing, and so on. People have looked at different kinds of brainwave activities, but that doesn't tell you anything necessarily about the content of what's in that, what's reflected by that activity.
I'm gathering that if you had your way, you would get rid of polygraphs entirely. They wouldn't be used. Am I correct in assuming that?
Right. Len Sachs, the citizen, thinks that they're not useful, and in fact, they're harmful. As a social psychologist, as a researcher, I am opposed to their use because there's no validity associated with it, and they are presented as a scientific technique. And that's not good. There's a larger issue, you know, should interrogators, should police, should official governmental investigators, wherever they are, should they be able to lie to suspects? Should they be able to tell people that they know information, or they know a co-conspirator who's, said X, Y, or Z? Should they, do they have to be truthful? Those are larger policy questions. I'll stay in my lane and just say, at the present level of scientific understanding, of human psychophysiology, and the practical way in which it's been applied with polygraph testing, there are very, very few instances in which it is useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see your point about it's an entirely separate can of worms about
right.
How investigators can mislead directly or indirectly, and how forcefully or direct those lies can be. Like, that's a whole area
right.
in itself, which is
right.
And clearly they
right.
they can mislead, and they do mislead in many different ways, and theoretically that's defensible. You can make different arguments about it. So yeah, I see what you mean about that's like a whole other category of things to talk about. Yeah.
Now, because in the academy, one looks at both sides of the question. So somebody would say, well, we have a system. We'll talk about criminal matters. We have a legal system where a jury of one's peers gets to decide to evaluate the evidence and gets to evaluate the testimony of different people. So use the Trump trial in New York as an example. 12 individuals listened to several weeks of testimony, and based on their judgment of the individuals and how truthful they were being, they made their determination. Some people would say, well, why is it that 12 people looking and hearing somebody who in most cases has rehearsed what they're saying and how they're answering questions, how can that possibly be better than actual psychophysiological data? And in fact, they may be using some of the crude, in a crude way and in a less systematic way, some of the indicators that a polygraph does, basically how nervous or anxious a person is just by their appearance, how focused
right.
they are.
It's all imperfect. It's imperfect.
It's all imperfect.
How you slice it. Yeah. Human justice is always imperfect, no matter how you slice it. Yeah. Sorry if I cut you off. I don't know if you're going to
say something. That's an easy summary of it. Good summary of it.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.
Is there any, I know you've done a lot of work in this area and maybe also related areas. Is there any research findings that you've done that you're especially proud of that stand out in your career that you'd like to mention and highlight?
Yeah, I think, originally when we did the work, and this is now a long time ago in the 1980s for Congress on the validity of lie detection, it was clear, that there wasn't a psychological and research an evidentiary basis for the test, but it was likely that the test was more accurate than chance. The question was why, and what we learned and what we wrote about is that the lie detector was not a lie detector, it was a fear detector. And so it worked because the subject was fearful of being detected. And my hypothesis was that it was the ability of the polygrapher to convince the subject that the test worked that led to both confessions. If you know you can be detected by this machine, why not save yourself some further anxiety and just confess to the to whatever it was. At the same time, you fear detection, and so you're more anxious when you answer a question about the actual crime. And there's no way to control for that. And I think, if you will, our theoretical explanation, our conceptual explanation of what was going on was more important. And then later on, talking about the role of habituation and how, particularly in criminal situations where when the person is tested, they've already answered the question dozens, if not hundreds, thousands of times, was a major contribution. I think I'm a scientist who thinks that I do my work not just to publish articles in journals and to simply add to the knowledge base of people, but also to affect public policy. And so later on, as a partial result of our work, the Employee Polygraph Protection Act became law of the land. Polygraphs were essentially banned from most workplace situations when there were limits placed on their use by government agencies in security investigations. And then later on, when the Supreme Court in U.S. v. Sheffer decided that polygraph evidence could not be was not considered reliable enough to be introduced into court. For me, those were both moments where I saw my work being directly used and used in ways that I thought made society a better place and made our justice system a more just system.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, do you, I realize you and I are on the same page with knowing that there's not reliable ways to detect deception, but I'm curious if there are other technologies or approaches that you think do a better job than the polygraph. For example, I know there's been, I interviewed Dino Levy, who was a researcher who did work about using this machine learning algorithm technique that involved like monitoring facial muscles combined with some other things. But I'm curious if there's anything you've heard that you've been impressed by in that regard, even if it's, you know, clearly these things are still like much higher, much lower than 100%. But I'm curious if anything stands out to you.
Well, the problem is, there's no theory that explains it other than the kinds of things that I was talking about. Sometimes we call the fear of detection, the bogus pipeline effect. So I don't care how many measures you have of people's physiological reactions. Those are not necessarily connected to whether they're telling the truth or not. There are some people who are anxious when they're telling the truth. I used to say sometimes when I testified in court cases that it was one of the most stressful things that I do. I'm a university professor, accustomed to talking before groups, but you sit in a witness chair in a federal courtroom or a state courtroom and somebody's life is on the line. And I have the classic physiological signs of anxiety. My throat is dry. I might even sweat. Whatever. It has nothing to do with not telling the truth. I am working as hard as I can to be as truthful and to be as accurate. I know if it's a defense attorney cross-examining me, he/she has hundreds of pages of transcripts of other testimony I've given. You know, I assume that the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court is going to read the transcript of this hearing. Mm-hmm. So I'm working as hard as I can. That makes me anxious, and I'm aware of that. Until we can identify, again, unique physiological reactions, whether it be muscular, cardiovascular, or otherwise, I don't see the prospect of it, and I don't see the prospect in terms of using large data, using computational linguistics, or how people say things. And maybe politicians from Franklin Roosevelt to Bill Clinton, Nixon to Donald Trump and even Biden are all good examples of people who we know that they have lied in particular ways, but part of their skill as politicians is either to believe their lies or to believe that they are doing them for purposes which, in terms of other than fear of being detected or understood as liars, there's no reason for them to be specifically physiologically reactive to that. It's also the case that People in these positions may actually believe their lies. And to use the presidential example, when Kennedy was elected, took office in 1960, he did an interview, I think 90 days after he was in office, and the interviewer asked him, President Kennedy, what surprised you most over the first 3 months of your term? So what surprised him the most is that things were really as bad as he had claimed in the campaign. So again, we each construct reality in a particular way. We often remember the last way we put together reality. And until we have a way of, you know, actually detecting what is in the brain and actually how people think, I don't see the prospect of a psychophysiologically based lie detection technology.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. I mean, I actually talk about that in my polarization aimed book about there's research showing that, you know, narcissistic people can convince, you know, often believe the things that they say, which just goes to show, narcissistic or not, we can believe our own, you know, exaggerations or self-deceptions or things that we say. We build a narrative, whatever it is. It's very easy to convince ourselves of these things, which adds a whole nother element of difficulty to these kinds of things. And I sometimes think, you know, about the lie detection, it's like, well, theoretically, if you had something that was like 100, you know, near 100% or 100% reliable, but then it's almost like it would have to be 100%, because if you start getting into like 99%, 98%, then it's like the more reliable it becomes, it almost creates more unfairness the time, you know, it creates more harm the time it is untrue or it's not right, right? Because that's when the more a society believes it, then the more you're going to ruin somebody's life when it's not, you know, when it's not true and these kinds of things. So there's a fine balance there, and which points to, you know, the difficulty of trying to use these kind of tools at all, even when they're like near 100%, right?
And, you know, one of the problems is that we have a society in which we're not very forgiving, particularly of public figures. And so it's not a society in which if somebody does something improper, even a minor transgression, that they can admit it, because then the assumption is, well, they've done all sorts of other things. And so we put lots of pressure on people to construct whatever they've done in the most favorable light. Mm-hmm. I used to do this thought experiment. I used to ask people, imagine that you're driving down a road and you essentially go through a red light, and get to the other side. You see a police car, or their lights on, pulling, and you're being pulled over. And what do you think about, I would ask people, when that happens? And most people construct a story. Well, when I got to the line, the light was really yellow. It was really yellow, and, you know, it was actually green when I got to the line. And you rehearse the story that you're going to tell the police officer. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is that my hunch is that you can repeat that story to yourself a couple of times before the officer actually gets to your window and asks for your driver's license. And by the time you tell them the story or her the story, you don't any longer know what actually happened.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, I've caught myself, you know, I'm curious about those phenomena too. So I've caught myself where I'm like telling myself a story, and then I'm like, that wasn't really what happened, was it? Or it was more complex, you know, but it's just so easy for us to create narratives and fool ourselves. Yeah. Yeah. And I often, to what you said, I think I'm somebody being somebody who's very anxious and has a problem with that. I do sometimes think about how I'd fare in these interrogation kind of scenarios. And I can imagine being, you know, like mentally stressed enough after, you know, 12 hours of interrogation or something, like where I could imagine being in a frame of mind where I was like existentially destabilized and giving a false confession to like end it. You know, these kinds of things are in my realm of understanding how people get there. And then you throw in like a false lie detector thing too, you know, it's I can see how those things happen. So I'm very sympathetic to those scenarios and think about that. Is there anything else you'd like to throw in here that you think is important?
No, I think, and I've said it in a couple of places, but let me emphasize it. How truthful we are with one another is clearly a central issue. It's a central issue on, as I mentioned a couple of times, on the political front, but it's a central issue in how businesses work, how the academy works, et cetera. And the polygraph is for me a distraction from the main event. How do we create more honest, ethical relationships with one another? How do we create environments, again, whether it be in the academy, whether it be in our communities, whether it be in our workplaces or whatever, that promote honesty? And the polygraph and the simple assumption that you can be detected by crude measures of autonomic arousal. It's ridiculous. You know, historically, the polygraph as we know it today, the basic test was created by a psychologist, or important people behind the creation, a psychologist at Harvard, William Marston. This was in the 1920s, and created what's called the systolic blood pressure test. Marston went on, he got thrown out of university. He was living with two women, and he became the creator of the Wonder Woman comic. And in the Wonder Woman comic, he was obsessed with honesty and truth. There's this thing called the magic lasso. This was the, if you will, the fantasy of the polygraph. And that was from over, that was 100 years ago. The science of this hasn't indicated that we have a magic lasso. And I think, as I said a moment ago, it is a distraction from the main business of figuring how to deal with honesty and dishonesty in our society, to continue to rely on this device.
All right. Thanks a lot, Len, for your time.
Sure.
This has been
great.
Appreciate it. That was a talk with psychologist Leonard Sachs. This has been the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. You can learn more about it at peoplewhoreadpeople.com. I'll put some of the resources mentioned in this episode, including past episodes of my podcast related to this topic, in the entry for this episode on my site. Thanks for listening. Music by Small Skies.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.